I'm Daniel Chacon. Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire. Today, our guest is fiction writer Christine Granados. She just came out with a new book of stories called Fight Like a Man and Other Stories We Tell Our Children. She is an El Paso writer. And because she's an El Paso writer, I have an El Paso co-host sitting in the studio with me, somebody everybody in the literary community in El Paso knows and knows very well and respects. He's one of the most active writers and community activists, and his name is Roberto Santos. Say hello, Roberto.
Hello. Thanks for having me on the show.
And I have a soft spot in my heart for Roberto, not only because he's a great guy. I mean, just meet him immediately, you know, this is a nice guy. But he was a student in our MFA program years ago.
I'm back home.
He came all the way from New York. You're a Puerto Rican Jew from New York.
I'm a Dominican Jew
from New York.
Yeah, or like my family calls me a Jewinican.
I think you might be the first Jewinican we've had on
that.
But years ago, when you were a first year MFA student, that's when we first met. Mm-hmm. You had your hair all the way down your back. It was very long.
Yeah.
And now you just kind of shaved your head.
It's easier.
But you came to El Paso to study the MFA, and
that's
then
right.
You ended up staying here, and you're still here.
I'm still here.
Years after. How many years ago did you graduate?
I graduated 2010. Now it's 2017?
Wow.
I haven't lived anywhere this long. This is the longest I've lived anywhere.
Why did you stay in El Paso?
Well,
other than meeting a wonderful woman that you married,
yeah,
but that came even later.
That came later. You know, really what kept me here for so long was the barbed wire open mic series that I helped to organize and found here
when
in El
you
Paso.
Were a student
when
in
I was
the
a
MFA
student
program.
In the
you
MFA
and
program.
Veronica Guajardo
and Trent Hudley.
Yeah.
Yep.
I didn't know you were, you three organized that, and it's still going on, very
it's
strong.
It's still going on. My colleague, Richie Marufo, is in the driver's seat right now.
Right.
I'm kind of in the back seat. I'm the back seat driver. But, you know, it's expanded. We're on TV now, public television. It's called the 306 Sessions on public TV here in El Paso. And the open mic is all over the place.
Yeah. And it
different
gets
venues.
Great crowds.
Oh,
it gets
yeah.
Great crowds.
Oh, yeah. And Richie Marufo is doing a great job with that event.
He's a wonderful host and organizer and activist. And you, who are a, you came in as a poet.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one of my favorite poems that I've ever heard you recite, because you like to memorize poems and perform them.
I like to.
Is the poem about being a Jewinican.
Yeah.
Am I saying it right?
Jewinican.
Jewinican.
Cool.
Jewinican.
Yeah.
So since your MFA, you have been active in the community. You are now a professor at El Paso Community College.
That's
You're
right.
going up for tenure this year?
I'm up for tenure. I turn in all of my paperwork, all of that, and then we'll see if they want to keep me.
Oh, I'm sure they will. They'd be crazy not to.
I hope we'll see, you know.
Well, you're going to help me talk with Christine Granados, who you know, and you've read this book. So thank you for co-hosting, and maybe you can come on the air, you know, occasionally and co-host a show.
I'd love to, and I look forward to our interview here. As you know, we brought Christine down to El Paso Community College, and she read. She performed for my creative writing class and had an awesome talk with them, and then she had a reading at a place we call the Little Temple.
Right,
and we had
right.
a good
beautiful,
crowd.
Beautiful forum.
And
there.
She shared some of her work with us.
Excellent. Well, let's not delay. Let's talk to Christine Granados. First, let me give a little bit of background. Christine Granados was born and raised right here in El Chuco, Texas. That is El Paso, Texas. She has worked as a journalist for the El Paso Times and the Austin American Statesman. She is currently a reporter for the Fredericksburg Standard Radio Post. And I believe her first book of fiction, which came out, I think, in the Camino del Sol series of University of Arizona Press, a great series, was called Brides and Sinners in El Chuco.
In El Chuco.
In El
That's
Chuco.
Right.
And this is her second literary collection of stories. It's called Fight Like a Man and Other Stories We Tell Our Children. So stick around and we'll talk to Christine Granados. Christine Granados, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
You know,
how did you guys get the name, Words on a Wire?
That's a good question. I think we were Benjamin Sines and I, who were the first host. We're just sitting in, I think it was the Rincón de Cortés, eating enchiladas and trying to brainstorm. And that just came to us, Words on a Wire. So why do you like it?
I love it. I love that. title.
You know, a lot of people get it mistaken. They say, "I'd love to be on Birds on a Wire." I go, well, good luck.
Where's that?
But we're honored to finally have Christine Granados on Words on a Wire. You are an El Paso native, and this is your very latest book, Fight Like a Man and Other Stories We Tell Our Children. How long has it been since you've lived in El Paso?
Ooh, we're looking at about 20 years, possibly, but I still just haven't gotten it out of my system.
Mm-hmm. Why is
that? That's why I keep writing about it.
Why can't you and other writers who come from El Paso, no matter how long they are away from El Paso, continue to write about El Paso?
I don't know. When you're born and raised on the border, you look at things differently. You have a very different outtake on life. And it's really funny because anywhere I go, I draw border people to me. I don't know what it is, or we just draw each other to one another. Mm-hmm. And like, I have a friend who's from Del Rio, and we immediately got along. She's a border dweller as well, but she hasn't lived there about as long as I haven't lived in El Paso.
The cover of your book, the cover of Fight Like a Man, has this amazing picture of El Paso. And as we go through the book, and I can't separate, you know, the city from what's going on to the characters. It's almost like the city is a character in itself, you know, in this book. Can you explain some of how El Paso shapes your writing or, this book in particular?
Yeah, I'm glad you said that because El Paso is a character. I mean, because of the heat, because of the people, because of the way it's laid out and the agave, everything is a character, the scorpions, the lizards, so it can't not be a character. So I'm glad you saw that. I guess everything I view in life is shaped from the Chihuahuan desert perspective.
Wow. Yeah.
And this has really nothing to do with what we're talking about, but I cannot grow plants inside my home in Fredericksburg because of the humidity here. Because I was so used to growing plants in El Paso where you just watered, and there was no humidity. And so it's still shaping who I am.
Yeah, that's really interesting. You know, when you came out to talk to my creative writers at EPCC, mm-hmm. and you asked them to sort of tell you a little bit about their lives and their stories and what they're writing you know, they would begin to speak to you and you would ask follow-up questions, right? Like you would ask them to tell you, you know, well, where did this happen? And, okay, you were in the front lawn. And what kind of,
what did you smell?
What did you smell there? Is it dirt? Is it gravel? And you alluded to the idea that all of these little details add meaning to the story. And you said something like those white rocks.
Yeah, the glitter rocks.
rocks, right? Mm-hmm. That they mean something, just like a dirt lawn would mean something, right?
Oh, absolutely. If you can afford the giant glitter rocks, that means you're well off, as opposed to the ugly gray gravel that's pretty cheap by the pound. So you know who is wealthy in El Paso, depending on the landscaping and xeriscaping that they have in their front yard.
And also you can say a lot about their personality based on whether or not there's weeds growing all out of it.
That's right.
That's true.
So we infer things, right?
And God is in the details.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. The devil is in the details.
That's right. I love it.
You know, I was taking a train to El Paso with my kids when they were really young. And there was these northerners that were up there, and they were talking about mowing their yard and doing the lawn. And they didn't understand how here in Del Rio and El Paso, how do people do yards? I mean, how do kids make money? And I had to interrupt, and I said, well, you get hired to pull weeds out mm-hmm. of the gravel.
Yeah.
We still do our lawn. It's just not as plush as maybe up north in Minnesota.
That's right. Yeah.
So what authors who have come out of El Paso have influenced you, or do you respect, or do you maybe dialogue with? Because in essence, every book we write is one voice in a discourse community. We're kind of communicating not only with the readers, but with other writers. What writer do you from El Paso do you really respond to? And I know the answer is probably going to be me, but go ahead and choose someone else this time.
Well, I did love Anna Shadows Took Him, so that's great. When I saw you in Austin, it was a lot of fun. But
yeah, definitely.
As always, it's my pat answer. It's Dagoberto Gilb and Magic of Blood and Gritos, his essays. His last known resident is Mickey Cunha. But I think I've said this a lot of times, that he was the first author I read who was writing about urban Mexican Americans living paycheck to paycheck, you know, driving junky cars. Mm-hmm. His work was something I could relate to.
Right.
And then in the process of finding him, I found Estela Portillo Tremblay, who is another wonderful writer from El Paso, who writes about working class women and women who work and raise children. And I love her stories. And I love that she was born and raised there. And my father even had her for English class.
Mm, wow.
Really?
That's awesome.
Yeah, it is. And I didn't even know until much later. I was reading Rigoberto Gonzalez's. He had a review of one of my first book. It was in the El Paso Times, and he mentioned her. And I was like, who is this woman? I didn't even know who it was. So I looked her up, and then I read her books and her plays. It's like, oh, my goodness, I'm missing out. And then my father told me, oh, yes, I remember Miss Tremblay. And I was like, you had her for a class?
Wow.
And he said, sure. He said, she had really nice legs. That was
That's what
that
he
was
remembers.
All he remembered.
Oh, yeah. How about really nice sentences and passages?
Yes.
Yeah.
But he didn't even tell me.
Amazing.
So your first book was called Brides and Sinners in El Chuco.
Yes.
And, of course, El Chuco is a way that people from El Paso refer to their city, El Chuco. And then this one, how many years later? 10 years later?
Yes, 10 years later. It took a while to finish this book.
So what happened between that last book and this book? And how is this book maybe different? Or how is it the same?
I'll start with different. It's the novella. I tried to write a novel. I really did. But it didn't work out. It became a novella. The reason I started writing a novel is because when I was talking to agents in New York and Los Angeles, they all said they love my collection of short stories and they like these short stories, but they can't sell short stories. So write a novel and get back to me. So I had about maybe 5 or 6 agents say that. And I guess I tried to write a novel, but it became a novella. So I failed and I still don't have an agent.
Or you succeeded differently.
Yeah.
But it's also the same, very similar to Brides and Sinners in that it's about El Paso and it has a lot of very strong female protagonists. And it's about dysfunction and daily living in a border city.
When you received the Literary Legacy Award at the community college here, before you read from your book, you said that this book is kind of like Eat, Pray, Love, but like not like Eat, Pray, Love. Can you explain that a little bit more for us?
I always I preface when I start reading that the novella, which is titled Fight Like a Man, is the main character is Monica Montoya, and she's filled with a lot of middle-aged woman's angst. And so she goes searching for something better, just like Gilbert's character did in her memoir, Eat, Pray, Love. So the biggest difference between the two main characters is that one is an upper-middle-class housewife, while the other one is a working-class Mexican-American housewife. Mm-hmm. So as you can imagine, it changes the story just a little bit.
Yeah, one travels the world and the other one kind of lives in El Paso.
Mm-hmm.
Right, exactly, because Monica isn't a woman of means. She doesn't have the luxury of traveling to Europe and Asia in search of a better life.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so she can't sleep with exotic Brazilian men to get recharged sexually.
Yeah, right.
Or visit an Indian ashram to find spirituality. Yeah, so she has to fill her middle-aged angst with more practical locales and people.
Yeah.
And so she does this, like you all suggested, by walking through her neighborhood and hooking up with a small-time drug dealer.
Mm-hmm.
And she gets her spiritual guidance from her half-sister, Bernie.
In one of the stories called The Good Father, the way you describe baseball is so accurate, and I can see the whole thing. And I'm wondering, with that kind of ability to and love, really, in the language of describing how the players are moving. Are you a baseball fan?
I am, actually. I played softball for a long time, and then I covered the Diablos, AAA basketball, when I was a reporter at the El Paso Times. Mm-hmm. I was the first female that they hired there. And so I got to cover the Diablos, which was really
that's
great.
Why you're so good at it.
That's right.
I really enjoy baseball.
So
my kids don't play either. They don't want anything to do with sports.
If I can ask, then how did you make that jump? Because you were sports writing, and you dabbled in journalism. I might be wrong, but I think I'm right.
I still am a journalist.
And you still are. So how do you make that transition from? Is it the same thing? Can a journalist just jump into being a fiction writer, or is that something that grew on you, or that you had to learn over time?
I had to learn. I'm sure other more talented writers can go back and forth, but I had to go to school.
For journalism or for fiction writing?
For both. Well, I went to school for journalism because that's how I thought, oh, I can write. And then I went to get an MFA in creative writing to learn how to write literary fiction, which is my love.
Where did you get your MFA?
At Texas State.
Oh, so you studied with Dagoberto.
Right. I went there because he was there. Dagoberto Gil, Tim O'Brien, Chris Offit, Tom Grimes, Leslie Mormon Silko was wonderful.
Great.
Yeah, I was just really blessed and lucky to be there at that time.
Yeah. What did you find the most valuable lesson or technique that you might have picked up in graduate school that you apply to your own fiction?
Well, when Dagoberto Gil was teaching a class, he told me not to overthink like a lot of MFA writers do.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, just write the story from your gut. He said, pretend you're at lunch with someone and that you're trying to keep their attention. He said, and in just like when you talk, when you go to lunch, try to keep somebody's attention and you're editing a story as you go, because if you're boring them, you can tell looking at their faces.
Right.
So just write the way you would talk.
That is good.
Like, that makes, yeah.
When I was a student of Daniel's, I was taking his metaphysics. It was a metaphysics and poetry class. And we were looking into metaphysics for metaphors that would inform our writing. And I wrote this long poem and I worked on it. I had worked on it so hard. And I said, this poem, this is the poem. This is the one. And I'm going to impress him and he's going to love it. And then I brought it to class. I think, I don't remember, we shared it or he read it. And he looked up at me and he says, the form of this poem has nothing to do with what you're writing. Just straight up like that. The form is totally off, he said. And I remember it was hard. It was hard to take. But I took it and I went back and I continued working it, you know. And sometimes we need those eye openers, right? Those professors who come along and tell us, you know. Yeah, we need it.
And then sometimes we you know, we screw up a writer for the rest of their lives. They don't want to write again.
Some people.
I have a similar story with Dagoberto in my first book, that short story Goldfinger in there. It's about kids, latchkey kids, who hang out and get into trouble. And I wrote it for a creative writing class to be critiqued, and everybody got a copy. And all 16 of my peers hated it, and they didn't understand it, and they didn't think the characters were believable, and nobody lives like this. I mean, they went on and on. And the professor at the time agreed with them. I started taking notes. And, you know, they were telling me, you need to play up the beans more. The dad needs to be angrier, and he should probably be a drunk, and he should... And so I took notes. So
all the stereotypes.
Night,
all the stereotypes, right?
I went home. I rewrote the story in one night, and I handed it in, and I gave it to the professor for the next class, and he loved it. He was so proud of me. And he read it out loud to class, and I was beaming. Wonderful. So I took this story that I'd rewritten and I walked down the hall, and Dagoberto helped him to be in his office. And so I walked in and I said, hey, I rewrote the story, Goldfinger. He said, I remember that one. And so I handed it to him. And he read the very first paragraph. And he's not even maybe three sentences. And he said, this is, I won't say it on the air, but this is awful, is what he said.
Wow.
And I didn't, I was mad at him. And I didn't believe him. And I thought, this man doesn't know what he's talking about. There's 16 people.
Yeah.
Right. But then I calmed down and, you know, I came back and I realized, oh, he's right. It's, he told me it's a stereotype of what a white person thinks a Mexican family should
right.
be like.
Oh, my gosh.
And that he was exactly right. He
you
was
know,
exactly
you know
right.
being a Latina writer, there must be that catch-22 that all Latino writers seem to experience, that if you write accurately about the people from your community, you're accused of being of writing stereotypes.
Mm.
And so it's almost as if there's some sort of pressure to write about Latinos in, quote, fresh ways. Like, for example, they don't want to hear any more about the cholo. They don't want to hear any more about the farm worker. They don't want to hear any more. You know, they want some sort of, you know, like perhaps middle class characters. Do you ever get, you know, feedback and say, your characters are stereotypes, when really what they are accurately portrayed human beings?
Yes, with their flaws and their good points. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I do get some feedback from people, especially Mexicanos, who are upset that I'm showing the flaws of our community.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we have to take the good with the bad. And I think we're at a point in Chicano literature where we can be fully realized characters and complex and good and bad, and not just all good, bless me, upima good, you know, all bad, evil, white man bad.
Right.
We can do a little bit of both.
Yeah,
right. And we all are a little bit of both. Although, quite
right?
frankly, Roberto Santos, I just don't see the evil side in you, but I know it's there.
You don't have to see
you
it.
Have
you
to,
know,
it's there.
I recently did a DNA analysis.
Uh-huh.
And I realized.
Third evil?
I have colonizer in me as much as I have the colonized.
Okay.
You see what I'm saying?
Right,
so
right.
some of that evil is in my DNA. Oh, I don't let it out too much.
And you probably
but it's
you probably colonize your students' papers.
Always. Every day. I'm just messing. But, you know, starting from the beginning of the work, I like that Daniel said that you're capturing real people, you know, in your writing. And there is a scene in the first chapter of Fight Like a Man where the protagonist walks into this curanderas clinic, and it's so beautifully detailed. If you don't mind, I would like to read an excerpt of this just very, very quickly and then ask you a question about it. But
sure.
But it just really stood out to me. And so the protagonist walks in, and there's a gentleman in there. He's missing half of his arm. Half of his arm is gone, right?
Yeah.
And so
yeah.
And so she goes there because she's pregnant and she's wanting to lose the baby. Am I right?
Yeah.
And so she's looking for a way to get out of this. And she walks in and the guy says, ¿Estás aquí por un mal? He asked, are you sick? And then she says, pienso que estoy pregnant. Right? So she thinks she's pregnant. I say, staring at his arm, which ends mid-bicep. I want to know what happened to it, but before I think to ask him, he puts his nub under my face, lifts my chin, and studies my nose. He shakes his head, then takes my left breast in his good hand and examines my face. When he sees me blink and suck in air, he says, sí, estás embarazada. I don't know why this moment stood out to me so much, but is this a real thing? Like, how can you imagine this? This has to be real. You don't have to name any names, but is this real? Like, your attention to detail freaks me out. And my only choice is to think that this really happened to someone.
It's real. It's blended. A few things. I had a lot of people take liberties with pregnant women.
Okay.
It's weird. You're a magnet for being touched. And
oh, man.
But even before that, I have aunts. And my mother and my sister, when I was pregnant, they knew because they said my nose got wider. Apparently that happens.
And that's the marker of being pregnant, is your nose gets...
Right. Among others.
Okay.
And, when I was living in Rockdale, there was a woman, Mrs. Flores, who had 10 children. And I would go visit her, and we'd hang out because her daughter, one of her daughters, was a friend of mine. I told her I was pregnant, and the first thing she did was grab my breast. Not grab it, but just placed her hand on mine. Mm-hmm. And I winced because when you're pregnant, your breasts are tender.
Wow.
And she knew. She goes, yes. And she even told me I was going to have boys because of the way I was carrying my kids. And
was she right?
This was later on. Oh, yeah, she's right. I had two boys.
So, Christine, what is your next project now that this book is done? What are you going to work on next, fiction-wise or creative writing-wise?
I'm thinking of many things. Right now, I'm studying David Romo's book, The
Ringside Seat to a Revolution?
Yes. I love that last chapter where he has the DDT baths or and what happened under Tom Lee, our mayor, I guess colonistic, racist mayor, who didn't like Mexicans.
That's a weird town to not like Mexicans.
Yeah.
I love that you went there. And he was a germaphobe, and so he sprayed down all the Mexicans coming across because he thought they had typhus, I believe
Goodness.
And there was an epidemic at the time, but it didn't really hit El Paso very hard. Mm-hmm. But they did this kind of gassing of people between 1917 all the way into the 30s. And they even had these giant dryers where they would have people strip who were crossing over from Juarez into El Paso. And they would throw their clothes into these dryers to be disinfected from whatever vermin they thought were in. And there was a riot. So Mexican women didn't want to do this anymore. And it's just an interesting time.
So you're going to write about that?
I am, and I've been trying to get a hold of people whose grandparents lived through that.
Good luck. I hope you enjoy geeking out on research, because that sounds like it could be a fantastic story and something that needs to be told. Christine, thank you so much for joining us on Words on a Wire. The name of the book is Fight Like a Man and Other Stories We Tell Our Children, and it's just out from the University of New Mexico Press, a fantastic press. Congratulations on this book. And
great work.
Oh, thanks. And thanks for having me, y'all.
Thanks for being on the show.
We'd like to thank our guest, Christine Granados, for joining us, and Roberto Santos for co-hosting. Thank you for being on the show, Roberto.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was a lot of fun. Hopefully I can come back and continue to help out.
Absolutely. Maybe when a mutual friend of ours, Trent Hundley, just came out with a book, maybe
Definitely.
We can interview him together.
That'd be good. I'd love to pick his brain.
Yeah, let's do that then. Well, you will hear from Roberto Santos again. I'm Daniel Chacon. Thank you for joining us. I'd like to thank our producer, Kimberly Garcia. Nothing would be possible without her. Thank you, Kimberly. And thank you. And join us every week on Words on a Wire.